Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Easter Monday edition, or the opening day edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with a tanned, rested, and ready Jim Garrity back from spring break. He also of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us. We've got good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. But, Jim, I just want to say I know you're feeling very grateful. The last thing you said before leaving at the end of week before last was that I'm sure nothing important will happen while I'm gone. There were no major cultural debates, no major international issues flaring up, just a real calm time while you were gone.
Yep, slow economic news. It was actually really nice to be not really following the news for a week, because every time I would check, you know, open the newspaper, turn on the TV, or look at Twitter, it was all outrage, 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 outrage. And I didn't miss it at all, but we're back now, Greg. So there we go.
Excellent. All right, on to the good martini now. And it's always interesting when there are Democrats who are a little bit nervous that there's not more serious competition for the 2016 presidential nomination. Yes, O'Malley's probably going to run, maybe Bernie Sanders. But for the most part, the field at this point is clear for Hillary Clinton. And we're in April now, so if anybody's actually serious about getting in this race, they're running out of time. And that's not sitting well with former two-time presidential candidate Gary Hart, the man you might argue is responsible in part for the reason Bill Clinton got elected in 1992. But he has serious reservations, according to Politico, about a Hillary Clinton candidacy. The prospect of a billion-dollar Clinton campaign ought to frighten every American, he said in an interview with Politico, and Democrats would be better served by a competitive primary that forced her to speak in more depth about the issues. I like Hillary Clinton. I really appreciate what she and her husband have done, but we need new leaders. So he's not just saying we need to have more people in this contest to make sure she's ready for a general election. He's saying we need somebody else as the nominee.
You know, what's nice about this little, it's just a short comment from Gary Hart, is it illuminates so many of the problems with Hillary Clinton's bid. There is that sense of a coronation, a sense that this is the argument that, you know, this is a royal family issue. I believe it was Martin O'Malley who said, you know, a couple of days ago, that this is the presidency is not a crown to be passed between two royal families. And I understand Chelsea Clinton said, well, why not? so there's that aspect. The enormous fundraising, the fact that she probably isn't going to have any serious challenger for the nomination. No offense to Martin O'Malley. Let's intend some offense to Martin O'Malley. No one takes him seriously. You put all this together, along with the fact that she's deeply connected to Wall Street, deeply connected to Goldman Sachs and folks like that, and the fact that she will cynically play this populist card of she's for the little guy. I remember, you know, way back when some liberal writer saying that Hillary would be running as lunch pail Hillary. Lunch pail Hillary. I'm willing to bet she hasn't eaten out of a lunch pail since probably grade school. And so the idea, though, it's this deeply cynical, inauthentic sense that the, you know, progressive industrial media complex, with a great deal of support from those who have done the best during the Obama years, are effectively purchasing the presidency. And we have somebody like Gary Hart making that case. We can make the case, you don't have to be some crazy right winger to say, whoa, 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 whoa. Americans are not well served by this. And, that maybe this, Bobby Jindal says in terms of, you know, when he gets asked about his fundraising for his presidential bid, he says, look, we're having a primary, we're not having an auction. At some point, raising a lot of money might actually be a liability to this. And you know, we'll see if Republicans can utilize this. But I think there's a strong bipartisan case to be made that this is close to a restoration of aristocracy or even monarchy in this country. And you know, we're not supposed to stand for that.
Yeah, we used to just be fascinated with the royal families and maybe the Kennedys once in a while. This is getting a little bit too close.
Jobs Americans won't do.
Exactly. All right, on to the bad martini now and the Rolling Stone rape allegation, which turned out to be largely untrue, if not entirely untrue, at the University of Virginia, has been in our martinis before. But now through Rolling Stone publishing its own report from the Columbia School of Journalism saying, yes, we got the story wrong. We're officially retracting it. This, of course, after the Charlottesville Police Department found no evidence that the rape existed. And now it goes into how this happened. The overall editor only reads about half of the articles in each edition. Then there's the managing editor, Will Dana, who could have looked more deeply into the story drafts, but decided that it wasn't important for the author of this article, Jim, to actually go and interview friends that this Jackie referred to in the article to see if she was actually telling a consistent or even a true story. So there's this kind of list of checks you go through to make sure a story this explosive is true. But apparently the salaciousness was just too much to go through all that work.
Yeah, there's two aspects. I think somebody put it well, saying that when you have a you know, just absolute disaster like this, you can do one of two things. You can change the policies. In other words, how you go about your reporting, how you go about your fact checking, how you go about your editing, or you can change the personnel. And I think to the surprise of a lot of people in the media world, Rolling Stone has chosen to change neither. They're absolutely convinced that this was a unique set of circumstances and that they don't need a more stringent system of fact checking for stories like this. And the other thing is that they're not changing any. The really surprising one is that the reporter Erdley is not being dismissed. And I think it was Seltzer over at CNN who asked, if this doesn't get you fired, what does? This is about as epic a screw-up as you can possibly make, really doing great damage to the name and image of your publication. She offered a kind of, struck me as a rather mealy-mouthed apology for it late last night. And we're kind of left with this circumstance. So what is changing at Rolling Stone? The other thing which I would say I kind of feel like isn't getting nearly enough attention in this, Greg, is the sense that if there had been, if Jackie had come forward with a terrible account of horrific brutality at the hands of the Transgender Studies Department, if the perpetrators in her tale had been someone who the left liked, I can't help but suspect that the fact-checking would have been a lot more stringent. The reason stories like this and hoaxes get, no hoax can work if no one wants to believe them. Right. And this was a story that the folks at Rolling Stone and all their editors and all of a good chunk of, I'm just going to guess, their readership wanted to believe this one. They wanted to believe that this is another tale of these snotty, horrible, brutal, privileged, patriarchal white males on campus, and that they were the problem and somebody needs to crack down on them. And aren't these frats terrible, et cetera, et cetera. That if you tell a story that nobody wants to believe, they will be a lot more skeptical of it. And, you know, it's this, you know, probably the most vivid example we have of a journalistic culture where the narrative determines what the story is going to be instead of the facts. And look, over at Hot Air, they like to use the expression too good to check. Well, in their minds, this really was the mentality of the story, that even though a lot of the details in that in Jackie's account could not be corroborated, it was just too good. And I make air quotes as I say that. Yeah, I'd like to say, I also wanted to see the University of Virginia president, you know, be a little more contrite about banning all fraternity activities from campus on the basis of a false story. But I don't think anyone wants to learn from this. I think everyone's very happy with who they are. I think Rolling Stone believes that ultimately they did what they raised awareness. And that is much more important than getting the story right in their minds.
You think the people at UVA are ready for this year to be over? But you got that story. There's been a couple of abductions and murders. Then you had the racial incident with the alcohol cops a couple of weeks ago. It has not been a good year for the for folks in Charlottesville.
The good news is they'll get to own a Rolling Stone soon.
All right. On to the third martini now. And this is from the New York Times. Their reporter, Alan Rappaport, decided to dig into Jeb Bush's voting records in Florida and found out that when Jeb Bush updated his voter registration card in 2009, he marked his ethnicity as Hispanic. Now, of course, he is married to a Hispanic woman, Columba, and he's very much in touch with the Hispanic culture, lives in the Miami area. But, Jim, it doesn't change the fact that he's the son of George and Barbara Bush, which makes him anything but Hispanic. I don't know that this will matter much, but at least some Elizabeth Warren fans are going to be happy that there's somebody else they can target here.
Well, yeah, you just put your finger on it. If Republicans nominate Jeb Bush, we really can't make fun of Elizabeth Warren anymore. And this is one checked box on a voter form. It's only used for demographic purposes. It doesn't really amount to that much. But there are a lot of people who are going to, you know, kind of roll their eyes at this and say, he's convinced himself that he's Latino. He's convinced himself that he's something that he isn't. I think that you know, Latinos themselves will probably decide whether or not that strikes them as some sort of inappropriate claiming of their heritage or their culture or something like that. Some might take it as flattery. I think it just kind of looks kind of silly and phony. And unless you could say, no, my hand slipped, I meant to check white. It seems a very little bit odd for somebody to insist that they are something that they are not. And, if you're looking for reasons to not like Jeb Bush, you throw this on the pile. if you already like them, you kind of dismiss it as not really serious, and we'll see how it shakes out. I think what perhaps it's most interesting is David Frum, in the fascinating essay a little while back, contending that Jeb Bush basically likes immigrant America more than he likes native-born America. And it was a rather incendiary charge, and some might argue whether it's overwrought or something like that, but that he sees great things coming from immigrant America, that they're more entrepreneurial, that they're harder working, et cetera, et cetera. The problem is there are a lot of native-born Americans who that's not going to sit well with. And the idea that, you know, he's going to, you know, if you say, it'd be interesting to ask Jeb Bush, do you think of yourself as Hispanic? And if so, what does that mean? And I think there'd be a lot of chewing that over. And, you know, America has always been a land of the Great Gatsby and reinvention, and you can be whatever you want to be. But I think a couple people might kind of be left scratching their heads and kind of left thinking, like, this is something a little strange about a guy who wants to claim that his heritage and his ethnic identity is different from what the genetics would say.